You're tuned to Awake Radio. This is Del on a Friday evening. Today is Friday, the 2nd of November, 2012. And I have a guest with me tonight. She's a very knowledgeable historian. She's the author of two books and countless articles. And she has her own radio show on the Republic Broadcast Network. And her name is Deanna Spingola. And I'd like to introduce you all to her. Hello, Deanna. How are you?
Hi, I'm very well, and you?
I'm grand, yeah. Still pulling the devil by the tail, as they say over here.
You know, I had ancestors from Ireland, and I've never visited there, but I've seen pictures, and it just looks like this lush, wonderful place. And I did cover Ireland, what they did to the Irish during the so-called potato famine, actually that was orchestrated in order to starve a bunch of people so that they would leave the island, they would leave their homeland, yeah, and come over to Manhattan and work as slaves in the early corporations. And it was a terrible situation. It was just awful. And I've had a guest on my program, Christopher Fogarty, who has covered this this terrible, terrible time in the history of Ireland.
Yeah, so it was a true Holocaust in the sense of the word. Food taken, food, cattle, you know, all livestock taken at gunpoint. They had ships basically ported all around the island. And
yeah,
then we're taught in school over here that it was the potato, you know.
Yes, it had nothing whatsoever to do with the potato.
Not at all, no. And sure, even up to now in this country, you know, I only found out a couple of years ago that we were only truly independent for about 3 years. We had an All Ireland 32 county election in 1919, where everyone voted for a sovereign republic, as opposed to any other, you know, democracies or anything like that. And you know, within 2 years there was a civil war. And the government we have to this day is still only a provisional, you know, the parliament and everything, it's all only provisional. It was actually set up by King George V, you know.
Hmm.
Yeah, we're over here thinking that we're in a, you know, we're still controlled by the crown all that time, you know.
So, very interesting.
Yeah, but anyway, Deanna, to get back to yourself, you've written two books, The Ruling Elite. The first one is The Ruling Elite, a study of imperialism, genocide, and emancipation. And the second one is The Ruling Elite, the Zionist seizure of world power. So,
right.
Yeah, would you like to give the listeners a brief outline of, you know?
Sure.
Yeah,
They are, we talk about them on my website, which is spingola.com. That's S as in Sam, P as in Paul, INGOLA.com. And the first book, I talk about the so-called Civil War, some of the things that happened prior to the Civil War, and bring that up to about World War I. And the second book, The Ruling Elite, the Zionist Seizure of World Power, I talk about the Zionists and about how they created the environment to start a war. Talk about what was going on in the United States and the financial situation that the Zionists set up so that they could start having massive warfare. Now, let's go back to the first book.
Yeah.
The first book is about the so-called Civil War, but actually what it was a socialist war. And many of the people that were fighting, that had fought in the socialist revolutions in Europe in 1848-49, actually came over here to America and fought in this socialist revolution, which was actually very successful. Now, the ones in Europe were not. And so thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people came over here to America, and they were successful here, wherein they failed over there. And we often think that the first real socialist revolution was the Bolshevik Revolution,
yes,
in 1917 in Russia. But it really wasn't. It was really in America. And and it just changed the entire structure of the government here. It allowed for a corporatocracy to take a hold. It allowed for the entire structure to be taken over. And then it just continues to get stronger. The communists continue to get stronger from the so-called civil war forward. Until there's a total takeover, probably in 1933. And, you know, I just cover a different aspect of history. We've all been taught in the government schools, what to believe, and, but it's all false. It's all false history. And I presume that it's, that false history is taught in all of the schools throughout the world. Because when these, corporate moguls took over the education system in this country, Rockefeller was supposed to be in control of the school system here in America, while Carnegie and his foundation was assigned the schools throughout the rest of the world. And so throughout the world, we are really indoctrinated to believe certain things that are not true.
Yeah. It is. It's vast when you sit back and think about it. You know, like that's history. You know, the schools are being, you know, taught lies. Basically, it's the same with the medical. You know, Rockefeller was in at the beginning of that too. You know, this so-called.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, and you know, you'd wonder where it's all going to end, because the way they have it set up at the moment now, it's, you know, the Middle East, you know, and banging the war drums for Iran. And,
right. Basically, they started doing that back in the early 90s, like 91, 92.
Yep.
And the people in Israel were basically taught to expect that there would be a war in Iran as far back as that. And this is one of the few countries that still does not have a central bank, although they have financial difficulties. They are still free from paying usury, and that is what it is all about, is control of assets, control of the world's countries through the financial system.
Yeah, like the fractional reserve. They're just, you know,
yes,
just gotten to the stage.
Yes.
They're just printing it out and nothing. People are signing for these things, and, you know, they're coming in and they're just taking the physical assets off people. I could even see it here in this country. There's people losing their houses, you know, every day, because they have the court system is all wrapped up in it as well. Like you, anywhere in the world, it's the same court system. It's the bar, the British accredited registry, and they all sing off the same hymn sheet, you know. And,
exactly.
Did you know Rockefeller was over here as well in 1973? And our government literally gave away all the mineral rights. You know, it's something, I know it might sound small, but we've something like 4.5% of all the world's output in natural gas and oil. You know, I didn't even know that up to a few years ago.
Really?
You know, you wouldn't think of Ireland
made
as
a deal with.
Yeah. They made a deal with Rockefeller, and that's never been sorted out. No one has ever seen licenses for this or anything. It was just done underhandedly, you know.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Now, the Rockefeller family, according to a book called The Grandees, The Story of America's Sephardic Elite, it's by Stephen Birmingham, that family is Jewish.
Right.
And when you actually look at all of the things that family has done, and you mentioned the medical industry.
Yeah.
It's incredible. I mean, just the cancer industry alone is worth billions and billions of dollars a year through their fake treatments. Well, you know, they don't treat the patients. They don't cure the patients. They treat them.
Yeah.
And their only treatments consist of three ways: radiation, chemotherapy, or surgery.
Yep.
And they only have 3% success rate.
Yeah.
And that's terrible. In other words, this is a profit a for-profit industry, and of course they have all of these organizations and which also collect money.
Yeah.
Because they give people hope that it, you know, oh, if only we will give some more money to this society,
yeah,
then they're going to find a cure for cancer. But in fact, cures for cancer were discovered over 100 years ago. There are patents in the U.S. Patent Office that date back to before 1900.
Yeah, and they'll never see the light of day. Well,
no, never. And they kill people, or, you know, minimize people, marginalize people, put them in jail in order to prevent the knowledge from being known.
Yeah.
And that's terrible.
Yeah, there's a chap there, you would have heard of him. I think you had him on your show, Rick Simpson.
Right.
Run from the Cure.
Right.
Yeah, he knows what the, well, we know ourselves, you know. But, of course, they have that all sewn up as well because, you know, that particular flower is illegal in most places. Yeah.
Right.
They control it, yeah.
Well, yes, they criminalize anything that they can't put a patent on.
Yeah. And that's one thing they can't put a patent on, you know.
Not yet, anyway, not yet. Unless they develop some GMO seeds and then they can do that. But apparently Israel is the only country in the world that wherein they can legally grow it. And so, of course, they know the properties and the curative properties of that plant. And they're going to exploit it, I'm sure, for the benefit of themselves and charge, you know, huge amounts of money.
Yeah.
It's a terrible situation.
It is. That's the one country, you know, well, most of the stuff I get, I buy out of local farmers markets and things, but if I have to go to the supermarket for anything like that, I know for a fact, you know the way barcodes, you know the way they all start off with numbers? Well, over here, anything with 729 at the beginning is from Israel.
And,
yeah, and I'd make a point of pointing it out to people in the store.
Right.
I'm not buying that. That's from Israel. You see what they're doing over there to the Palestinians?
Yes.
You know? So that's my little contribution when I go into the supermarket anyway. But, I remember back a few years, well, you know, at the height of apartheid, and there was an Irish supermarket over here at the time, and it was all over the mainstream media and everything where some of the workers just decided to embargo on South Africa, you know, to highlight, you know, what was going on over there. And looking back on it, you know, when things are in the mainstream media, they're in there for a reason, and it wouldn't be the good reason that we'd, you know, think. And I often wondered about that. You've never seen a mass kind of outcry about what's going on, you know, in Palestine.
Oh, and you never will.
Yeah.
And getting back to the supermarket issue, mm-hmm. We have what is called a kosher tax here, and I'm sure that you have it there also, wherein the rabbi has to go in and, you know, make certain that the meat is slaughtered in a kosher way. And there's a symbol on, gosh, I would imagine 90% of the products that we purchase here in the stores,
yeah,
that they have had the rabbi come in and make this food kosher. And this involves often the restructuring of a plant so that it will be kosher, you know, like the double sinks and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And people are unaware of this, but I'm sure you probably have that in Ireland too, because I know many countries do have this kosher tax. And it might be, you know, just a little bit of money on each product. But the fact is that they are only about 2% of the population, and yet 98% of the population must pay this tax without even knowing that they're paying it.
Yeah. Well, you see, that's one of the things, you know, like a lot of people, they don't see beyond that, you know, the media is controlled. You know, like you said earlier on about the education, the media is the same. Anywhere where there's, you know, westernized style media, it's controlled by the same people. You see the same names coming up all the time.
Sure.
And even some of the so-called big ones out in the Middle East, they're all controlled as well.
Like Al Jazeera?
Al Jazeera, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, I know that early on that the U.S. military bombed that station over there, so.
Yeah, it probably had a regime change.
Sure.
Yeah.
And we've had a controlled media in this country since 1927, and before that, actually, but the government formalized it in 1927, and this was through the Radio Act of 1927, and this was when Herbert Hoover was the Secretary of Commerce. Now, he worked for the Rothschilds for a long time, basically since he graduated from Stanford University. Yeah. And in he graduated in geology and that kind of thing. And shortly thereafter, he went over to the UK, over to Britain, mm-hmm. and started working for a company over there. And he came to the attention of the Rothschild family, and he certainly has been working in their behalf since then. And we must presume that he worked in under their jurisdiction, under their guidance when he was the U.S. president. But anyway, he introduced the Radio Act of 1927, wherein all of the radio stations in America had to be registered and licensed. And right now they have a board of governors that used to be seven, but I believe it's down to five, and those are all approved by the president. And so people in this country are under the illusion that we have a free press and that we have freedom of speech and all of this kind of stuff, and they don't recognize that this Radio Act of 1927 cut that right out. I mean, we are probably the most censored country in the entire world, and yet people think that we're not. Now, certainly we can still talk about things like what we're talking about here on this radio program, but you could not do that in the regular press. In fact, they have what some people think is an alternative media, and that's the Fox News and their subsidiaries.
Yeah.
And they pretend to be the alternative media, and they often refer to the mainstream as the left. You know, they're leftists, and the mainstream doesn't cover everything. But Fox News, supposedly fair and balanced Fox News, is giving out all of this this truth when it's in fact it's run by a bunch of Trotskyites.
Yeah, just the likes of Glenn Beck and company. Yeah. Just crocodile tears. But even then you have the so-called alternative media, you know. You've got a lot of them there. There seem to be a lot of gatekeepers there, you know.
Indeed.
I'm sorry to say it, but, like, you know, I have to say what I see, you know. And it might, you know, I learned a lot of stuff at the beginning from the likes of Alex Jones and whatever, you know, the information and stuff. You know, just going back a good few years. But seen through him as well, you know, I think, you know, when he made that statement that the Arabs run Hollywood and stuff like that, was just ridiculous.
That's preposterous. Only a fool would believe that stuff.
Yeah. It is ridiculous, you know. I don't want to alienate myself from, you know, people, but, you know, that's my view on Jones anyway.
Right. But, a lot of people say, well, but he does produce a lot of good stuff. But if you can't trust everything that he says, and I'm sure... I mean, there's a difference between misinformation and disinformation. Misinformation is are people who they disseminate things that they believe to be true, that they've, you know, maybe they've been indoctrinated, and they give out all this information that is false. And then there's disinformation, and these are the people I call them the 90-10 people. 90% of the stuff that they say is true, but maybe 10% isn't. But their listeners are going to accept 100% of what they say as factual.
Yeah.
But it isn't. And certainly they do act as gatekeepers in the most essential information.
Yeah.
And that information usually includes the criminal cabal who's running everything. And they just fail to mention who that group of people is.
Yeah. You hear bankers, or you hear the elite, or the Illuminati.
Sure.
You know, whatever you're having yourself, there's loads of different things. But, Deanna, could I ask you to go back? You're fairly knowledgeable on the Rothschilds and that. But could you, you know, tell the people out there that might not necessarily know the history of how far these guys go back, but, you know, the original, the five sons.
Right. I covered this quite a bit in my first book.
Yeah.
And I talk about how they were living in Frankfurt, and a lot of people say, oh, their name was actually Bauer, B-A-U-E-R, and that is not true. They shared a home at one time, because a lot of people in the ghetto, which is Judenstrasse, was the main street in the ghetto in Frankfurt where they lived. There were about 2,500 of them, Jewish people who lived in the Frankfurt ghetto. And that included the Rothschilds. And the father was Meyer, and he was a merchant, and as many of them are. And he had a secondhand shop, and as part of that secondhand shop, and he owned it with some other people. And he started, he had been collecting old coins, and they would allow people out of the ghetto during the day, and then they had to be back by a certain time, and they would lock it up again. And, well, first let me say something about ghettoization.
Yeah.
Now, before they were emancipated by the officials in Frankfurt, they did lock the ghetto up. There were guards, and they collected a tax, which paid for these guards. But after the emancipation of the Jews, the rabbis, for their own devious purposes, insisted that these Jews did not assimilate, that they did not become a part of any of the communities in which they lived. And this was so that they could keep very tight control on the Jews, because they live by the Talmud, and the Talmud covers absolutely every single aspect of a Jew's life. What they eat, what they wear, how they wear their hair, just every single thing about a Jew's life. And so to maintain, and also to maintain exclusivity, which is something that you still see, depending on where you live. Of course, a lot of them in this country, in America, have assimilated. You know, they've gone into the media, they've gone into the banking, they've gone into the media and publishing and whatnot, or they have minions who though they're not Jewish, they certainly serve the Jewish agenda. But anyway, Meyer, it's M-A-Y-E-R, had five sons. He also had five daughters, and he sent these sons, as they grew older, into other areas, Paris and Rome and England. And Nathan, who was very, very, very skilled, ended up going to London. He initially started out in the textile business, and he was made a lot of money during the Napoleonic Wars, because somehow he had a deal so that his ships could get through to Frankfurt, and other ships could not.
Yeah.
But they basically, relocated and took over the banking industry in France and England, and they started their gold operations and started the globalization of trade. Now, the Jews have always controlled trade throughout the world, and they had trade routes. And these are maintained to this day, because they were the ones that were the traders. Mm-hmm. And they were not farmers. You will rarely find them doing any kind of manual labor. Mm-hmm. But they are always in the trades. We're always in the trades, where they would benefit by being the middleman. For instance, if the farmer had things to sell, he would go to the middleman, and the middleman would add something to the price, the cost of the goods.
Yeah.
And the farmer would make just enough to live on, and the middleman would be making a fortune because he would be selling a lot of goods. He had a monopoly. And so they were in the trades, whether it was opium going to China or whether it was, you know, now we talk about the sex trade, the slave trade, trafficking in sex, trafficking in body parts, trafficking in diamonds. They have a monopoly on certain trades, and they still have a monopoly on the drug trade.
Yeah.
And that is why they promote warfare, so that they can keep these monopolies. And yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. And even in the South, you know, in our country, the so-called Civil War, the South, the North, did all of this. They were the center of mercantilism, particularly New York City.
Yeah.
And the South did not do any kind of production at all. They were agrarian, although they grew a lot in the North. The South never developed their production capacity, and so they relied on the bankers up North to get loans from in order to plant their crops, and then they relied on the shipping up North to ship their things to England, where they had a big trade there, and then you had the triangle trade, where they were transporting slaves from Africa to America and then to the Caribbean. It's just amazing to read about all this stuff, and what a ripoff.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, this has gone forward, gotten bigger. And when you hear terms like free trade, it doesn't mean free trade. It means that countries have sacrificed their sovereignty, and there's no tariffs, no way to protect the production and the jobs of any country. Say, for instance, America, when they did the NAFTA agreement back in 1992, they gave up the rights, they gave up production rights in this country.
Yeah.
And now they're seeking cheap labor wherever they can find it. And we certainly have globalization. It'll never come back. You know, we're going to have an election here in this country next Tuesday. And you have both of the parties, which are both controlled by the Jews. The left is controlled by the Marxist Jews, and the right is controlled by the Zionist Jews. And so you have control of both parties, and they're both promising that they're going to bring back jobs, and they're going to do this and that. And they never address the real issue of why everything has fallen apart and why America is descending into a third world nation. It is because of this globalization. It is because of the free trade agreements. It is because the government sold out to the bankers and created this legislation called free trade, and basically are disseminating desecrating the middle class in America, so that there will be the rich and the poverty stricken.
Yeah, an awful lot more of the latter than the former.
Oh, absolutely.
And you know, as well as that, then you think about the likes of the United Nations. There's another separate where they're whittling away at, you know, everyone's freedoms and things. This is Agenda 21. That they're, you know, you can see it where they're bringing it in. You know, they're trying to get pack people into cities and make places. You know, you can't build here. You can't do this. You know, you can't even grow your own vegetables anymore in some places over in America, you know?
Right. And of course, this started with a corporatocracy after the Civil War. A lot of people before the so-called Civil War were agrarian. There were lots, millions of small farmers. And then the corporations started, and they want They wanted slave labor, cheap labor. And so a lot of people left the farms and they went to the cities. And then we were talking earlier about how all of these Irish people came over, mm-hmm. To work. And, you know, they manipulate things in one country to accommodate, the labor needs in another country.
Yeah.
And, that was how they did that. And you can control people. In fact, Rothschild called capitalism the European plan. And capitalism and communism are very much the same, except communism is by force, and capitalism, you think that you have freedom. You think that, oh, capitalism, isn't this wonderful? We get to make money and we get to do this and that. Yeah. But when you consider that the corporations are in control of your life and they can shut down the corporation and move offshore and you lose your job and your home and your future and everything else, yeah. The corporatism is basically a plan, a way of controlling labor, and they control it through corporations, and it's monopoly capitalism.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult now for the small business person to make it because of all of the government legislation that they have to accommodate all of these rules and regulations, and then they get taken over by the bigger guy. The bigger corporation gobbles up these small corporations, mm-hmm. Just as they gobble up land during any kind of an economic catastrophe. And we've had several in this country.
Yeah.
And when that happens, then the bigger farmers take over the small farms. And the small farmers, and this happened in the South, mm-hmm. where you had all these plantations, and many of those plantations were owned by big guys that came from the North, came down and bought up all this land.
Yeah.
So the small farmer just was eking out a living.
Pretty much the game plan all over the world, you know. It's pretty much the same in Ireland as well. People that were barely getting by on the little, you know, parcels of land they had. Yeah. But
right.
But what's even gone worse now today is that they have merged this evil scientific bullshit, excuse the language, but where they're manipulating, you know, like the likes of Monsanto, they're creating these, you know, these vile, genetically modified plants and stuff. And
right. And so many of the food crops are genetically modified, and they don't label them.
Yeah.
So people don't know what they're eating. And so you really have to investigate to see exactly what you are eating. You know, call the company and say, ask the questions. And too many people, you know, in this country, honestly, there are people who have never heard of the term genetically modified.
That's unreal, isn't it?
Yes.
It's sad.
And of course, it's a function of the media to conceal all of this stuff. That is their function.
Yeah.
And they do a very good job of it.
Yeah, and then the likes of the food additives, you know, the aspartame and things like that.
Right.
You know, they're copping on with that one now. They've changed the name again, haven't they, to something else?
Well, the patent on aspartame it went away. The patent it expired.
Okay.
And I'm not sure when the exact date. But now they can call it anything they want. They call it natural flavoring or something else. And so it's just imperative that people, you know, not even reading labels. I mean, if there's a label on it, then you probably shouldn't be
eating it.
Be eating
if you can't pronounce
and,
it. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And certainly if you can't pronounce the ingredients on a food, then don't eat it.
Yeah.
You know, shop in the outside perimeter of a grocery store, because that's where the things are that, you know, the fruits and vegetables and I try to go to the farmers markets during the summer and buy grass-fed beef that have not ingested any steroids, and try to buy produce that is organic, but it's just very difficult.
Yeah, we're kind of still lucky over in Ireland here as well with the beef and stuff like that, where they don't allow growth hormones or anything like that, you know.
Right. And I read that and I thought, oh, if I ever relocate, I'm going to go to Ireland.
Well, we have another problem over here, and is that they heavily fluoridate the water.
Well, yeah, they do that here too.
And they also do it to some of the food products. There's some cheeses, for example, that I would never eat over here because they are caked in fluoride.
Wow. Yeah. Well, anything that, like, juices or, you know, concentrated juice, I'm sure that they probably have used fluoridated water for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, of course, you can buy filters, but most filters that you purchase will not take out the fluoride.
Mm. That's right. And they're trying to bring in water charges over here soon as well. I'd like to see them try to get away with that one. Yeah.
And of course, you can buy bottled water that is not fluoridated, but you need to, again, go to the company and find out, you know, whether it is fluoridated. And the other thing is the packaging.
Yeah.
If it's in soft plastic, well, there's another problem.
That's it, yeah. There's various numbers. I don't know if you know that. You know the little triangular symbol for the recycling?
Uh-huh.
And there are various numbers going from 1, I think it's 1 to 7, and then beyond.
Yes.
And there's only, 2 or 3 out of all of them are sort of safe enough. Well, they haven't been proven to, you know, be as dangerous as the rest of them.
Right.
You know, so I think it's 2 and 3 and possibly 5. Now, that's what I always look at as well if I'm buying anything in a plastic container. I try to avoid
it. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is awful. And the thing about it is that it is deliberate. This isn't like inefficiency. Oftentimes government officials, Bush was very good at this.
Yeah.
He acted like he was just kind of ignorant and just kind of bumbling along and, oh my goodness, you know, there wasn't any weapons of mass destruction, and oh, but we sure thought there was. And they act like they're just totally, totally inefficient. And certainly if these people worked for others, they're supposed to work for others, but certainly if they worked in a regular job, they would have been fired for such inefficiency. I mean, after 9/11, nobody was arrested. Nobody was culpable for that thing. And yet, 3,000 people died and all kinds of destruction occurred.
Yeah.
And nobody was held accountable for that.
No.
But so you have to say, okay, this is what they're doing to the food is not accidental. It is deliberate, and you have to figure out, okay, well, who is behind this? Why would they fluoridate the water? Why would they sneak aspartame in our food because it's rat poison? Why would we submit ourselves to vaccinations that have all these horrible things, live viruses and aborted fetal tissue and all of this other stuff? I mean, if you injected an apple with all of those things, monkey viruses and pus and all of this other things, and then, you know, ask somebody if they want to eat it, of course they would say no.
Yeah.
And yet they'll take their infant children to the doctor, and because the doctor seems to be an authority figure and wears white jacket, they'll say, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, we need a vaccination for our kid.
Yeah.
Oh, terrible.
Yeah, to go back to that, actually, the Rockefellers, right, they sort of, all over America at the time, and well, all around the world, I'm sure, there was homeopathic people and remedies and stuff, and they went around putting those schools out of business.
Sure did.
In very strong-arm tactics in some places. And,
absolutely.
You know, created this, what we know now as the medical profession, and it's all very, you know, official and white coats, like you say, and very clinical, and it's got the media behind it, and, you know, of course, people are bringing their children. It's madness, it is. It really is madness.
Sure.
It's
and
not,
there's some excellent books about this, like Rockefeller, Medicine Men, Medicine and Capitalism in America.
That's right,
The Medical Mafia.
Yeah.
which is also very good, and Copeland's Care, Homeopathy, and The War Between Conventional and Alternative Medicine by Robbins. And but they started a long time ago. The American Medical Association was basically created in 1847. And that was about 20 years before they introduced circumcision, which they did in 1869. And you also have to think about the dental industry. And about 1850 or so, the dentist in this country recognized that mercury was poison. And so they all had to pledge that they would not use mercury as a filling ingredient when they were, you know, working on people's teeth. And then about 12 years later, the American Dental Association was created, and they scrapped that and have been using mercury as a filling product ever since. But yeah, this started a long time ago, and Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller Sr., founded the Rockefeller Institute of Medical Research. And one of the first things that they did was that they sent out a gentleman by the name of Flexner, sent him out. He was Jewish, and his brother was Abraham. He had another brother. I can't remember. Simon. There were Simon, Bernard, and Abraham. And they... Rockefeller wanted, and some other industrialists also, wanted dominance over any resources that including petroleum and the petrochemical industries and everything else. And they also wanted a monopoly in the pharmaceutical industry. And so in 1909, the Carnegie Foundation and Rockefeller sent Abraham Flexner on an investigative tour of 155 medical schools in America and Canada. And Flexner, was his job to evaluate the entrance requirements, the qualifications of the staff, the financial endowments, the quality and suitability of the laboratories, and the relationship between the medical schools and the hospitals. And he concluded in his report, which was a 364-page report, was called Medical Education in the United States and Canada, he concluded that the medical education in America was horrible. And so they went about, the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and all, they went about destroying anything, any school that taught natural cures, and then they set up a licensing program where basically the American Medical Association took over the medical colleges and destroyed all the ones that didn't fall under the category that they wanted. And so then now what you have is you have a monopolization of medicine here in this country, where the pharmaceutical industry participates greatly in what is taught, so that there's no cures, but they focus on treatment, and the treatment they focus on, it has nothing whatsoever to do with helping the patient, but simply in the profitability of the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah. And of course, then that's all tied in with the insurance companies.
Sure.
Who are also making a fortune.
Absolutely. Because, for instance, like with car insurance, every single person that drives in this country, I think it's done by the state, but you have, by law, you have to carry car insurance.
Yeah.
Now, I have not had a car accident for decades. In fact, in my entire life, I've had one accident.
Yeah.
Exactly. I've had one accident, and that wasn't my fault. But I have carried car insurance all that time and, you know, along with everybody else. And so they pay the insurance companies all of this money. And now we have Obamacare in this country where everyone will be compelled to purchase insurance.
Yeah.
And the only people that are going to benefit, of course, are the insurance companies. But the problem is that people seem to think that there's going to be more health care, that people who did not have access to health care, now all of a sudden there's going to be more health care. No. The insurance companies are going to decide whether or not you can have a medical procedure. And there's not going to be any more doctors, there's not going to be any more hospitals, there's not going to be any more health care.
Mm.
It's just going to be more under the control of the government.
Yeah, they'll have a board to decide whether you deserve to live or die, you know, something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah. And right now, for older people in this country, the people who are on Medicare or other government healthcare situations, it is the government that decides whether or not how much you're going to pay and whether or not you're allowed to have a procedure. And that's just, you know, kind of a segue into Obamacare.
Yeah.
Terrible, terrible situation.
It is. And, you know, what's the situation over there with people actually, you know, waking up to this kind of stuff? Or, you know, is the majority of people still just, you know, listening to Fox News or CNN and just getting on with their lives?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. People who listen to Fox News think that they are especially informed, that they have all of this knowledge that those people who listen to CNN don't have. They really believe that they are listening to the alternative media.
Yeah.
And I tell them, I said, look, Fox News is the mainstream. Everything, if it comes through the TV, it is the mainstream. There is no alternative media outside of the Radio Act of 1927, unless you're talking about internet radio.
Yeah.
And even then, there are, like you mentioned before,
mm-hmm.
gatekeepers.
Yeah.
I'm quite certain there are gatekeepers on RBN, the network that I'm associated with.
Yeah. Oh, they're everywhere. Like, no matter if it's grassroots organizations, they'll try to infiltrate, you know.
Sure.
Of course.
Well, if you have a sponsor, if you have sponsors, if you have a network and you have sponsors, the sponsors are going to control some of the information that your network is dispensing.
Yeah.
Plain and simple.
Yeah, that's true. We're kind of lucky here at Awake, you know, we don't have sponsors or anything like that, or ad breaks, or, you know. And by the way, Deanna, if you want to have a break, you just let me know, you know, if we can have a music break or whatever.
Okay.
If you needs be. But there was another thing I wanted to ask you. I remember the first time I listened to you, it must be 3 years ago now. And I remember I was in the airport of all places and I had my MP3 player. And I just loaded a load of random stuff on. And it was the first time that I came across your show. And I think you were reading about, we'll go to Germany now, back to, you know, what the mainstream would say about, you know, bald man Hitler and everything like that. But I remember I think you were talking about some of his paintings and stuff before you got into the bones of what was going on in Germany at that time.
Right.
So, would you like to sort of...
I've had a radio program for just a little over 2 years, but I was on a lot of other radio programs as a guest.
Yeah.
And I started writing articles in 2005,
yeah.
And with regards to Hitler, everything that people typically think they know about Hitler is a lie. Most of the mainstream. The real mainstream say that, oh, he was a house painter, he was a down on his luck, you know, house painter. No, he was an artist. And he created beautiful, beautiful paintings that just very, very, nothing decrepit like what you see art has become now, but just beautiful paintings, and he's very, very talented. He wanted to go into architecture, but he didn't. But he was also, along with his architect, the people he hired to design buildings and roads and things, he worked right along with them in doing this. He was highly skilled. He was had a photographic memory. He didn't type. He was very prolific rhetorically. Had passion. An incredible genius, basically, who was he served in World War One, and I hate to use the word serve. You know, he was in World War One, and was devastated when Germany capitulated, and he'd been hurt. He'd been the recipient of some mustard gas, and he was in the hospital when he discovered when he found that. That the war was over and that Germany had capitulated. And so it's anybody who really wants to understand Hitler the man should definitely read Mein Kampf. And there are so many people that have taken statements that Hitler supposedly made out of context. And this usually has to do with propaganda. Yeah. And people will say, "Oh yes, he promoted the big lie, and the Germans used propaganda, and they said that if you repeat a lie enough, that people will believe it." Well, when he was talking about propaganda and the big lie in Mein Kampf, he was actually talking about the Jews and their use of deception. Their use of repetitive lying, and you can see this, of course, in the in what people refer to as the Holocaust, that if you say something often enough, that people will believe it. And of course, that's another topic altogether: the Holocaust, so-called Holocaust. Just about it. Well, okay, everything that we have learned in the government schools about Germany, about World War II, about Hitler is a lie.
Yeah, I'd well believe it, because I have one eye on the chat box here. I don't generally look at the chat box when I'm talking to, you know, somebody, but Dave Starbuck just put in there a few minutes ago, was he was a failed artist, wasn't he? Now, we were all told that one, you know,
right? But actually, he made money from his work. He wasn't, they either say that he was a failed artist or that he was a down and out house painter. I have not heard anybody in the mainstream or the alternative media say too many positive things about him at all. I mean, just to they denigrate him in any way that they possibly can, whether they say, "Oh, but he had dirty fingernails and he was grimy and dirty," and you know, I mean, you can't find anybody that says anything good about him. And I was having a conversation just yesterday about the swastika because I had a gentleman on my program, and the website, the New Order, .org. There's a swastika at the top, and this lady says, "Well, won't that really be a turnoff for people?" And so we think of the swastika. We've been trained to view the swastika as something evil and disgusting and terrible. Well, the swastika has been in culture, throughout the world. People have used that symbol in their culture for decades and, you know, thousands of years. And the first time that he saw one was in a church that he attended. And but everything associated with Hitler, they have denigrated it and made it evil. And so I'm writing a little article about the swastika, a little piece on the swastika, and I'm going to talk about it at some point, whether as a guest on a radio program or on my own program. Yeah. And we are a culture, whether you're living in Ireland or we are a culture that relates to symbols. Now, just a few minutes ago, you were talking about the symbol on the bottom of a water container, on a water bottle. And so we are indoctrinated to view symbols in our lives. I mean, the sports teams all have a symbol, an insignia. And, when we see these symbols, we look at the symbol, but then that is connected to everything that we know about that symbol. So when we see a swastika, we automatically think of, those evil Nazis and, the death camps and the Holocaust and the murder. And they've got us indoctrinated to, for instance, when we hear a song, we think of something else.
Yeah.
And we just live by symbols, it seems. I wish I had that right in front of me. But when you think of all the symbols that we have in our life,
yeah,
and what they mean to us, and the connotations that symbols have to our lives, and they function to keep us in certain little holes, to keep us compartmentalized.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing, like, after World War One, which was, yourself, contrived. Hitler went about trying to rebuild the country because he was elected. It wasn't like this guy just seized power, with his armies and whatever, there were proper elections. This guy was elected, and he started to put Germany back on its feet without the without the aid of a central bank and that whole system that we're under today.
Right, and in order to denigrate him, many people say, "Oh, the bankers funded him." Mm. Well, there may have been certain industrialists who gave money anonymously, which they did, but there are certainly books written about where he got where the financing came from, and they did not fund him. They did not put him into power. He was not Jewish, as some other people have said. Mm-hmm. And he basically threw the bankers out. Because at the end of World War One, the country had these huge reparations payments that they owed to these other countries. Yeah. Even though they did not start the war, did not want to be in the war, attempted to stop the war a couple of times during the war period, mm-hmm. They ended up losing a lot of their territory to other countries, to countries that they created at the peace conference. Yeah. For instance, Poland had not been a country since about 1795. They had become part of Russia, mm-hmm. and at the end of World War One, due to Wilson's 14 points, then they created the country of Poland, and they ended up divvying up Germany, some of the most productive areas, and gave them to other countries. And then you had all of these ethnic Germans that were now living in a foreign country under the jurisdiction of often a very hostile government.
Yeah.
And so Germany had no money, loads of debt. People had starved to death at the end of World War One because of the British boycott. The British, not boycott, but they sanctioned them. They blockaded. They had a blockade, mm. and this went on 6 months after the war. Wow. We think, well, the war ended. Okay, the blockade's over. No. The war ended, and in order to compel Germany to accept the Versailles Treaty, they kept that blockade up, and all these people were starving, mm. including children. And so when Hitler saw this, And they created a program through their party, the NSDAP. And Nazi is not something that they ever called themselves.
No,
Nazi is a term that was created for them by the Allies.
Yeah.
They never referred to them as Nazis.
Yeah. And a little aside there, Deanna, when I was talking to the Fetch there a couple of weeks back, he put it in the context of, a spell on words, you know, a Nazi, if you know
right.
what I mean. You're not seeing, you know, so Nazi. Every time you hear Nazi, you're not seeing the truth.
Ah, that's a good thing.
It is,
that's,
isn't it? I never thought of it like that, and I went, wow, that is, you know, there's something in that. But, yeah, it was a completely made-up word, you know. It was
sure.
a National Socialist, I can't remember the rest of it, but it was. You're right, there was no Nazi, per se, except on the Hitler Channel and everywhere else now, you know, or the History
right.
Channel, I should say.
Right. But anyway, he completely revamped the economy, and he said that they don't have any gold, and so he said the people are the gold here. The people, we have workers who want work, and we have work to be done, and that is what they wanted. And so he didn't make any deals with the bankers, and he put people to work and created an economic system that was interest free.
Yeah.
And got people back to work. I mean, there were seven million people out of work in 1933. He came to power as chancellor at the end of January 1933. He didn't seize power. The Reichstag fight. He didn't start the Reichstag fire. He didn't seize power. Mm-hmm. The president made him the chancellor. Because they had a certain amount of people in the parliament there. They didn't call it, it was not the parliament, they didn't call it that. So they had a lot of people who had joined the party because they believed the platform. They embraced the platform which talked about agriculture, talked about the foreigners that lived in the country, talked about the rights of the German people. The platform was absolutely wonderful, and it got rid of all of these people who were making money off the labor of others. We're talking about those middlemen who were making all the money. And he also said, you know, the Jews was about 1.5% of the German population, and yet they had like 70% of the power in the media and in banking and in academics and in medicine. And this was not right. And they had been controlling the media there since at least 1870 because they started gaining power. Well, first of all, from their emancipation, but then after the 1848 revolution, the Jews started gaining quite a lot of power in Germany, and kind of took over the media.
Mm-hmm.
And by 1870 was terrible. And so, you know, all of these problems, with the Jews didn't start with Hitler. In fact, there was a meeting in Germany, in Dresden, and it's a very interesting date, was September 11th. And 12th of 1882, the Germans brought together the leaders from several other countries and in Dresden in order to figure out what they were going to do about the Jews, because the Jews were causing problems in all of these countries. And this was in 1882. Long time before Hitler ever rose to power. Legally. And so he did something that nobody else had done, and that was to throw the bankers out and create an economic system that did not depend on usury, that did not depend on debt-based money, But on debt-free money, he put 7 million people back to work. They built bridges. They built the first modern highway system in the entire world.
Yeah, the Autobahn.
The Autobahn.
Yeah.
Built stadiums, built all these wonderful things. And the bankers did not like that, particularly the bankers, the bankers behind the government in Britain. They did not like that. They viewed Germany as competition before World War One, and they attempted to get rid of that competition by engaging in World War One, but it did not work.
Mm. I also heard, Deanna, I don't know how true this is because I haven't been able to, you know, I see a couple of articles, but I haven't been able to nail it down. Maybe you can help me with this one. But, you know, the 6 million number that we always hear.
Oh,
right. That was tried after World War One. Is that true?
Well, that was really earlier than that.
Okay, right. Yeah.
It's based on the Talmud and about, it's an occult figure.
Yeah.
That the Talmud indicates that before the Jews may return to Palestine, that they have to sacrifice 6 million of their number.
Oh,
and they started floating this during World War, before, as early as 1897 when they had the first Jewish, the first Zionist convention. Mm. They started talking about the 6 million number and tried to spin it throughout World War One. American Jews were talking about it in the newspapers. And during the war, they were saying, oh, 6 million Jews are starving in Europe. We've got to raise some money. And this raising of money via so-called humanitarian efforts really started earlier than that. It started with the Damascus affair, where they thought, oh, people, the Jews in Damascus are being persecuted. We've got to raise money, and it worked really well. I mean, it worked amazingly well. And so Jews have a wonderful way of raising money. And because people's hearts are tender and they're willing to give money to those that are less fortunate.
Yeah.
And when you talk about any kind of humanitarian effort, whether you're talking about the Belgian Relief Fund during World War One, which I talk about in my second book, which was just it was a platform for building profits.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it was Herbert Hoover that was participated in that. He made millions of dollars. And when any kind of a charitable effort,
yeah.
When you're talking about the American Cancer Society, I mean, if they ever revealed that they have, you know, dozens of cures for cancer, well, the American Cancer Society would close down,
yeah.
And the people at the top who make millions of dollars wouldn't have a job.
Yeah.
But anyway, they discovered this humanitarian facade, charade, and they've been using it ever since. And they realized that they could gather a lot of money together, which they did during World War One, by claiming that these poor Jews were starving and that 6 million of them were going to die.
Mm.
But nobody believed. Excuse me. Let me get a drink. Anyway, the people didn't believe it.
Yeah.
They didn't have the media control. They didn't have the media monopoly. They did not have control of Hollywood enough to promote the 6 million death figure in World War One.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
After World War II and the propaganda machine in Hollywood was set up, then they could make that happen.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned it there earlier on, and as far back, you know, Dresden. If anyone wants to talk about even the word, actually, as an aside, didn't somebody copyright the word Holocaust in America at some stage in the 70s?
Well, there were a lot of things that happened.
Yeah.
But the word Holocaust came to be something that was spelled with a capital H, and it was really, they focused on the so-called Holocaust in Germany, and so people associate Holocaust with the Jews,
yeah,
with the Jews that the so-called Nazis murdered in the gas chambers.
Mm-hmm.
And now when you use Holocaust, like certain words, we're talking about certain symbols,
yeah,
have certain connotations for us. Now that word Holocaust only means the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else can have a Holocaust.
Yeah.
Okay, they have allowed a few people to have a Holocaust. Let's see, I can't remember which group they allowed. I think the Armenians. There was some legislation not too long ago, perhaps in the 80s, where they said, okay, yes, okay, the Armenians suffered a Holocaust too. But really, when people hear the word Holocaust, they immediately think of Jews.
Yeah.
No other people.
Well, you see, like what we were saying as well earlier on, you know, some people go, oh, you're pointing out the Jews and it's just the Jews and blah, blah, blah. But the thing about it is that if you come to a certain point when you're looking at all this conspiracy stuff and you get to the stage where, well, then, right, if the media is lying to us about everything, which we've established already that they are, why can't people take that, you know, that extra little jump and leap of faith and say, well, all this mainstream stuff we're getting about the Holocaust and we're getting about the plight of the Jews is still being put out there, you know. So why can't people say, well, that's a lie too? It must be, because the rest of it is all lies, you see. Which I want to go back then to what I consider is the real Holocaust that took place during World War II, and that was the bombing of Dresden, you know. I was wondering if you could sort of tell people about, you know, the lead up to that and what actually happened.
Dresden.
Yeah.
I muted myself take a drink.
Yeah.
Was as I indicated earlier, mm-hmm, was the place that the Germans used together. I think it was like 135 countries to have this conference, this two-day conference on September 11th, 1882, to decide what they could do about the control, this disproportionate control that the Jews had in every single country. And I believe, personally, that the reason that they bombed Dresden, and of course both governments, the American government, the U.S. government, and the U.S. military, and the British government, and France, but it's mainly the British and the Americans, mm-hmm, who were doing the bombing, and they were both controlled by the Jews, and I believe that they chose Dresden as retaliation.
Yeah.
For retaliation. It was, there was nothing military about it. In fact, it was a refuge for a lot of the people who were leaving other areas in Germany to, mm-hmm, go to, because they thought that, you know, they're not going to bomb Dresden. I mean, it's not a military, nothing military about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that, the U.S. government, U.S. military and the British military were bombing every single city in Germany that had over 50,000 people. Mm-hmm. And then when they bombed all of those cities, then they bombed cities that were less populated.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about here is total war. And total war is a term that came into use during the so-called Civil War in America.
Right.
It used to be that warfare was fought in a battlefield,
yeah,
where two opposing sides would fight against each other out in a field. They didn't go after the civilians. They didn't go after the infrastructure. They didn't. There was no collateral damage.
Yeah.
And also the Civil War was kind of, you had the, had bigger weapons, you had more modern weapons, and then of course after the Civil War you had the development of even greater, more destructive weapons. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about total war, you're talking about everything is game, everything is vulnerable, food production, men, women, children, animals, everything is open for destruction.
Yeah.
Now, in the First World War, soldiers killed 9,911,000 people in action and wounded 21,219,500 people.
Yeah.
And there were almost 8 million people were missing in action for a total of 38,880,500. Mm. In the Second World War, there were over 24 million military deaths, but that was exceeded by 49 million civilian deaths,
yeah,
for a total of 73 million deaths, not including the number of wounded or missing.
Jeez.
I mean, that's 82,911,000 in two world wars,
yeah,
not including those missing from World War One, which was almost 28 million wounded or missing.
That's horrendous. Yeah.
Okay. Now that is the real Holocaust,
yeah,
because when you're talking about and some of the military deaths, we must remember that military that death during war is not always a result of being killed by a bullet.
Yeah.
It is the result of starvation, of disease, and even when you're talking about the Civil War, a lot of the people that died during the Civil War, and there were, 700,000 people,
mm-hmm,
550,000 in the South. A lot of that death was not because of military action, but it was because of starvation and disease. Because when you're living, when the military is living out in open fields and tents and stuff, they don't practice good hygiene.
Mm.
And so you're going to have a lot of disease. The big flu epidemic in World War One,
mm-hmm,
was a result of several things, but anyway, so you're going to have a lot of deaths.
Yeah.
But the reason that you had deaths in the so-called concentration camps in Germany and elsewhere was because of the Allied bombing.
Yeah.
Because the Allied bombing took out all the communication, took out all the transportation. You also had a blockade, the British blockade of Germany during World War II.
Right.
Okay. So you had Germans who were starving in everywhere throughout Germany, mm-hmm, particularly in the final months of the war. Well, if you're going to have starvation throughout the country, that starvation is also going to affect the people in the camps.
Yeah.
It is going to affect the government's ability to provide medicine and every other thing for the people living in the camps.
Yeah.
And the German government tried to protect the inhabitants of the camps from the lice infestation. Now, we don't have this big problem of lice infestation now, because our facilities are better, our hygiene policies are better, practices are better.
Mm.
But in Europe, during that time, you had people who were compacted together, whether you're talking about traveling on the trains or whatever. You had people who did not take baths on a daily basis. You had people who didn't take baths on a monthly basis. You had a lot of people who were really kind of dirty. They didn't practice hygiene. And there's a certain group of people, if you read the diaries of General Patton, you will find that this group of people who didn't like to take baths were the Jews. And so in the camps, The Germans used a preventative method to keep the lice at a minimum so that people would not get sick and die. Now, most of the men during World War II in Germany were fighting. They were fighting. They had the Western Front. They had the Eastern Front. So most of the men were gone. And so they did use prison labor. They used prison labor. But they paid these people. It was not slave labor. The people who were working in industries associated with the camps, for instance, Auschwitz was located near some factories. They paid these people to work in the camps. Mm. But they did use chambers, they used Cyclone B to fumigate clothing and bedding and all the rest to keep the lice population down, to keep people from getting typhus and typhoid and other things. Now, we don't think about other camps. All we hear, when we think of concentration camp, we automatically think of Germany. Mm. America had concentration camps in the Philippines. They had concentration camps for the American Indians. Yeah. The British had concentration camps in Africa for the Boer, associated with the Boer Wars, and Poland had concentration camps, displaced person camps for the Germans who were being deported from Eastern countries, and so they lived in camps in Poland. I don't know exactly how many camps there were. Eisenhower had camps. He had at least 200 camps in Germany where Germans were placed, where at least 1.5 million of them starved to death. Mm. But these camps that the Allies ran, the Polish ran,
you never hear
about. They didn't make any take any precaution to prevent disease. Mm. But yeah. The Germans, being the people they were, took precautions to make sure that the people who were living in the camps were free as much as possible from disease. But during the last months of the war, that all went by the wayside because they had run out of, you know, the transportation system was broken. Mm. So you had a lot of people who got really sick, who lost a lot of weight, who looked like Steve Jobs did right before he died of cancer. Mm-hmm. You had a lot of people who starved because of the Allied bombing.
Yeah. So there was actually a lot of camps in America, too, for the Japanese. And second, third generation Japanese Americans thrown in.
Absolutely. Many of those people weren't born in Japan.
Yeah.
They'd been here for a long time.
Yeah.
But those camps also had another function. There was the Japanese in California particularly, the farmers, did not charge as much for their produce, and so the farmers in California, the big agri-farmers in California, as soon as Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, which the government knew about, which they provoked by having blockaded their trade routes into Japan, mm-hmm. and Japan was wholly dependent upon imports. But they knew it was coming. But they allowed it to happen because then it could get them into the war in Europe, because Japan and Germany had an agreement that, you know, because they were allied. But the farmers in California thought, wow, let's ask the government if they couldn't please round up all these Japanese people, which they did, and they confiscated the properties and they shipped them off to other places. In fact, they even seized German property here in America, and there were Germans in concentration camps here. Well, we still have concentration camps. It's Guantanamo, and there's camps on an island, Diego Garcia, in the Indian Ocean, where they do rendition flights and take prisoners over there, And, of course, that's another story altogether. But yes, they do have, and of course all the camps that they have in Iraq where they, torture the prisoners until they confess to whatever that is they want them to confess to.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the Nuremberg trials.
Yeah.
And the Jews tried to have an international tribunal right after World War I. But it didn't work out. And so they worked on it, and then you had a fellow by the name of Raphael Lemkin, L-E-M-K-I-N, who created the definition of genocide. And by the end of World War II, then you had an international tribunal.
Right.
And so there's a lot of stuff that you can talk about and cover, but the mainstream media is never going to cover any of this stuff ever. They're not going to, you know, the people will believe what they read in the newspaper. They will believe what they hear on television. They will believe in what is in the movies.
Yeah.
You know, they will. Many people get their perceptions from things that aren't even true, that people write and make up. You know, television programs.
Yeah.
Hogan's Heroes, whatever.
I remember that myself.
So, and they get their perceptions from the media, even if it's, you know, fiction media.
Yeah. And as well as that, Deanna, you know, those camps originally, so-called concentration camps, they were kind of like retraining centers before the war, weren't they? Because, you know, the Hitler et al. Was trying to sort out, you know, when they say the final solution, it wasn't to gas people or kill them. They were trying to do something with the problem that they had in Germany and other parts of Europe. And they were giving these guys their own nation, which was supposed to be Madagascar at the time, wasn't it? Or that was one of them.
Yes. When we think of the final solution, they did have a deal with France, who had jurisdiction over Madagascar.
Yeah.
And they wanted to really allow the Jews who were living in Germany to leave. And they were allowed to take all of their assets with them. And when we talk about the first camps that were created in Germany, then they were created in 1933, and it was for criminals because there were a lot of communists in Germany,
mm-hmm.
and their prison system could not accommodate the people. And but these were actually criminals,
yeah.
that they had to sequester in order to, you know, to keep communism from spreading. And so they created the first camp, Dachau, in 1933. I think it was like in March, and it was for the purpose of you know, not allowing these people to create warfare against the country that they lived in, which they did anyway with, you know, international Jewry created economic warfare against Germany in the spring of 1933.
Yeah.
March 24th,
yeah. That comes up a couple of times, and the only reason why I noted it, that's my own birthday, funny enough. yeah, it was the same I was looking at when Cromwell. Well, it was the 24th of March.
Yeah.
16, whatever it was. I can't remember now.
Yes.
Often,
but uh-huh.
Yeah. So, goes all the way back to there. Well, it goes beyond that, but.
But, know, yeah, the camps weren't, you know, they were resettlement, relocation.
Yeah.
Towards the end of the war, they did put the Jews in camps, because then they thought, okay, they'll move west or east, you know, into the eastern provinces. And they did have a deal where they could go to Palestine.
Yeah.
And Germans, the German government assisted these people to leave the country. And many people left the country in 1933.
Yeah.
And a lot of the, because of the laws that they placed, they imposed, because of the economic situation that international Jewry imposed on Germany. I mean, it's, for instance, if in Ireland, in your country, if a 2% of the population, if, well, for, well, any country who has had war declared on it, well, like in this country, the Japanese, they rounded up all the Japanese because Japan declared war on us. Okay? And the Germans did the same thing. You know, the Jews declared war, and so, and so the German official said, well, my goodness, let's, we've got to take them out of these very, very influential positions. And so they encouraged people, the Jews, to leave the country. And there were some Jews that were very bitter, incredibly bitter, about being forced to leave the country. And it was some of these same, very, very same Jews who went back to Germany with the U.S. military after the war to help to interrogate Germans at Nuremberg. These most of the interrogators were Jewish, who had Jews who had lived in Germany before, could speak the language, and they were bitter, and they went back, and they provided interrogation services at Nuremberg.
God, that's really strange. You know, it's funny that you say over here in this country. Remember, I was telling you earlier on, you know, the old Rockefeller ripping off all our natural resources.
Mm-hmm.
Up to a couple of years ago, we had a separate minister for natural resources, and there was a few of us over here used to send registered letters asking them. I have replies here, but you might as well, you know, they're worthless. Asking them where were the licenses for these, you know, transactions. They can't answer it, right? But here's the scary thing that's going on over here at the moment. Now, there's a referendum coming up where they're trying to alter the constitution. And it's all about the children because they care so much about the children, you know. But effectively, what it'll mean is that the government will can take any child and put it into care and foster it out to adoption, right? Now, if that's not bad enough, right, and you're talking about whatever percentage of the population of a country is, they have managed to merge our defense forces over here because technically we don't have an army. We have a defense force, right? They've merged the Department of Defense with the Department of Justice, okay? And, yeah, but before that they merged the minister that was in charge of that, right, in charge of the justice, right, who, I'll say it now, he's a Jew. Alan Shatter is his name. A Jewish guy in good old Catholic Ireland here, right? But he's in charge of natural resources. And now they've merged basically the police and the army together. And he controls the three of them. And what else he did, which no other Minister of Justice would do at the, you know, down through the years, as soon as he you know, attained his, you know, we'll say power, but I like to say that the people empower these people. You know, they don't have the power per se without us, we the people. But basically the first thing he did was sign that treaty with America for rendition, you know.
Wow.
So basically, I could be sitting here, I could be feckin' disappear some night, you know, excuse the language.
Sure.
But it's, that's how crazy and how frank. And then while all this is going on, you just got ordinary people going, oh, don't talk about the Jews, don't do this, don't, you know, at this stage I'm going beyond caring about, you know, who hears what I say, you know, and that's
sure.
You know, that's just my own little perspective from, you know, good old Ireland here.
Right.
Know? And the amount of information you're after giving us tonight, it just surely any right thinking person can actually take that on board, you know, and work it out for themselves, you know.
Sure.
So.
Right. I have actually, this is not a popular thing to talk about. Because,
no, it's not.
They, early on, they created agencies and organizations. They're very, very well, they're very united, and they have created organizations that are designed to conceal their activities. And if their activities are revealed, then they have agencies that will, such as B'nai B'rith, which they created in 1843, and then the ADL, which was created in 1913. These agencies, the function of these agencies is to conceal criminality, the Jewish criminality, and to target anyone who dares to speak out against the Jews. And we can go back and we can look in the New Testament, and we can find the words for fear of the Jews. People did not want to talk about them. And so this is an age-old problem. Mm-hmm. And they of course use the anti-Semitic card, mm-hmm. and claim that they are being persecuted, when in fact they are the persecutors. They were the original terrorists in Russia, yeah. And you know, as I mentioned before, when I was growing up, and I heard about the Holocaust, I thought, wow. These people must have been so submissive to allow themselves to be to be killed like this. No. Their idea is they will hit a person, but they will cry.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is the way it works. Yeah. And we need to talk about it. We need to talk about it. We need to have the same kind of meeting that they had in Dresden in 1882 and figure out, okay, what is the situation? How do we solve the situation? I mean, they have been thrown out of over 70 countries at least 109 times.
Yeah.
Now, is it because of the countries, the people in the country, or is it because of the behavior of this people? Yeah. They are a minority population, and yet they exploit the labor of the majority of the people who work in the country. When you think of who do we go to get a loan for a house? Who do we go to get anything? Mm. We go to the age-old tradespeople. They've always been in charge of those activities that where they can make money being the middleman, where they can control the currency of every country and make usury. Look at the damage. They are behind the warfare. Warfare is very, very profitable. Yeah. And so what if they killed 82 million people in two world wars? They made a lot of money. Because you see, they see us as cattle. We are not people with souls. They are exclusive. They are the only ones with souls. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't matter to them that they killed, it was almost 83 million people in two world wars, because they made a lot of money and they seized a lot of assets. They seized a lot of the control over the assets of the countries that were involved in the war.
Yeah. Had not to mention the millions of people who died in the likes of the Ukraine and that, during the Red
Terror.
Oh,
yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
And then on top of that, all around the world now, all these people that are dying of cancer, that are getting Alzheimer's, it's all part of it's all the same fabric, you know.
We're looking and at a lot of people will not believe when you tell them, hey, you know, the reason that you aren't getting better with chemotherapy mm-hmm. or radiation is because it's not designed to make you better. It's designed to treat you mm-hmm. for profitable purposes. Yeah. And because most people are honest and considerate and compassionate and would never dream of hurting another human being, they don't believe it. They cannot conceive that there would be a group of people, an industry that is based on profit only, that would allow millions of people to die for profit. And so they're brainwashed into thinking that they're going to make it through this cancer. Yeah. When in fact, the treatment itself is designed to spread cancer mm-hmm. and to kill people.
Yeah. Well, I also remember as well, Deanna, the beginning of your first book, you were nearly going to call it the ruling psychopathy or the psychopaths.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And you see, this keeps coming back at me as well, you know. When I look around and when I see all the different conspiracies and whatever, you know, it is, I can't think like that. And you can't think like that. And most people that I know don't think the way these people think, you know.
Exactly.
And it is a psychopathy. And it's like as if, you know, and it's all given the go ahead in their books, the Talmud and everything else. So
right.
the people are born and are brought up into this kind of psychopathy where, you know, you have to go out and, you know, do the goyim, you know, get the money out of them and, you know, rip them off. So, but like for people to see it, you know, I find it very hard, you know, apart from the likes of yourself and the likes of other people out there talking about this stuff, that, you know, we're up against such a machine with the media and everything else, you know. One of my hopes is that it'll start crumbling from the inside where the people that are in there, the nuts and bolts, maybe, you know, the odd producer or the odd journalist, or surely, you know, they'll cop on somewhere along the line. Same in governments, you know.
Sure.
It could be just back to like Germany before World War II, where everyone starts seeing what's going on, you know. And that's my prayer anyway for, because apart from that, I don't know. You know,
sure.
These guys seem to have it. And then, I don't know how true this is, but I have heard it before, is it the Daniel option where they've got, you know, effectively they're blackmailing the world as well. Apparently there's nuclear missiles, or not missiles, but nuclear bombs actually planted in various places.
I would not put that past them. You know, when you're talking about the nuclear issue, terrible, terrible nuclear situation in Japan.
Yeah.
And of course, I totally believe that they were involved in 9/11. The Mossad was definitely involved in 9/11 in this country.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about the Germans. They did not just want to destroy Germany. They wanted to totally kill, according to the Morgenthau Plan. Mm-hmm. They wanted to totally decimate and kill the German population.
Yeah.
And thereafter, I mean, they had the denazification program, but they also Canada, for instance, invited a lot of Germans to come over, and they promised them jobs and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I think they wanted to get rid of the survivors of World War II, divvy them up, send them to all these other countries, Australia or, you know, America, Canada, mm-hmm. or wherever, in order to keep them from getting together and recognizing the real problem, mm-hmm. and becoming a real force.
And keeping them shut up. It's
yes.
like Ernst Zundel would be an example there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. What a brave soul.
Yeah.
What a brave, good, kind-hearted man. And he says, I don't hate Jews.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, he simply asked a question. He reprinted a pamphlet.
Yeah.
Did 6 million really die? And the answer is no.
Yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, sorry. No, I'm sorry for interrupting you. Yeah, but even at his trial, you know, one of his lawyers was put into jail because the truth was no defense.
Right, in Germany. Yeah.
In Germany. Now, if people can't see that you have to make legislation to actually shut somebody up, well, who is hiding? Who's making the legislation? Because if it happened, if 6 million died or if whatever happened, you think they would be allowing everybody to come and testify and say, you know, but they're suppressing because there isn't the people out there.
Right.
There's more people out there to say, no, it didn't happen, you know.
Right. Well, truth should not fear investigation. If something happened,
exactly.
And if it's true, you should be able to ask questions about it. They don't want anybody asking any questions because pretty soon other people are going to start asking questions, and their little facade will come tumbling down.
Yeah, and there's another saying as well, and it's a truism. because I can't remember who actually said it, but investigation or condemnation without investigation is the highest form of ignorance.
Indeed.
You know, people should get their facts straight before they go off on an emotional argument against this stuff, what we're talking about.
Yes.
Because you really do have to look at it, look at the evidence and analyze it and use, you know, like yourself, you use your own mind and, you know, your own critical thinking.
Sure.
And if everybody did that, well, people would be awake, but to be aware as well, you know.
Right.
But do you know something? Yeah, I can't believe it. It's 7 minutes to 11. there's another show coming up at 11. And I could go on listening to you for another 2 hours. But we'd have to kind of wrap it up, you know, in the next few minutes.
All righty.
So,
well, it's been wonderful talking with you. It's terrific.
I think it's great. And I just want to tell the people out there again, I'll put the link again into the chat box to your website, where you've got loads of articles. We're going back to 2005, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And your two books are on there as well. And the link to your radio shows as well on RBN.
Right.
Yeah. And what days do you do on RBM? You see, the way America and Ireland time zones don't, I generally go for the podcasts, you know?
Sure.
So what time do you be on live over on your shows?
Monday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday at republicbroadcasting.org.
Yeah. Oh, cool. And, yeah. So, Diana, I'm going to say thanks again for coming on, and you've been brilliant, and love to have you on again sometime.
Oh, I would be happy to be on again.
Yeah, it'd be really cool. So I'm going to say thank you. What I'll do is I'll put on a tune, and then I'll just have a chat with you off air just to thank you again.
All right.
I want to thank everybody out there that's listening to Awake Radio, and thanks for listening, people. And this has been Del on a Friday Night with Diana Spingola. And I'll just stick on a tune now. And coming up at 11 o'clock will be, my God, I'm so sorry about this, Vin, but it's Factually Speaking with Vin James. And he'll be on in a few minutes. So, okay, thanks, people.